Good afternoon and welcome to the Best of NERA 2011, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org, the virtual museum and archive of the history of financial regulation. I am Scott Keefe, professor of law, George Washington University School of Law, and moderator for today's program, the eighth in the Best of NERA series since its debut in 2004. The Best of NERA is a joint program of the SEC Historical Society and NERA Economic Consulting. Through its virtual museum and archive, the Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. Both the museum and the Society are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. Today's program, along with the rest of the museum collection, is broadcast and will be preserved without any SEC oversight. NERA Economic Consulting celebrated its 50th anniversary this year. It's a global firm of experts dedicated to applying economic, finance, and quantitative principles to complex business and legal challenges. The NERA experts advise government authorities, major corporations, and leading law, accounting, and auditing and financial services firms throughout the world. Since 2004, NERA Economic Consulting and the SEC Historical Society have worked together to broadcast the Best of NERA series, highlighting top experts from NERA. Under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archives, you will find the Best of NERA section, which brings together the programs since 2004 and showcases the diversity and depth of topics that this series has addressed. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the continuing and generous sponsorship of NERA Economic Consulting in making this series possible. It is my pleasure today to welcome three NERA experts to share their insights into economic issues that have resulted from the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. As regulatory agencies begin implementing the rules of Dodd-Frank, it is important to look at the economic risks and cost benefits of this new regulation. Joining with me today are Dr. Robert McKay, Senior Vice President of NERA Economic Consulting and Chair of NERA's Security and Finance Practice, who will speak on quantification of systemic risk. Dr. McKay also participated in the 2009 Best of NERA. Next, we have Dr. Faten Sabri, who also presented in the 2006 the Best of NERA and is a NERA Senior Vice President. She will look at the implications of the new risk retention rules on securitization. Third, we have Dr. James Overdahl, NERA Vice President, who will address the role of cost-benefit and impact analysis in regulatory rulemakings. We'll begin the program with Dr. Robert McKay kicking things off. Please.
Thank you, Scott. I want to turn to the topic of that's really been driven in large part by the Dodd-Frank Act, and that has to do with sort of identifying systemically relevant financial institutions, or maybe more ambitiously put, quantifying systemic risk. For the last 2 years, we've been legislating and regulating in this area, and certainly the regulatory part of this is guaranteed to proceed for quite a while. While longer, we'll hear more about that in the next two talks. But this effort, of course, is a response to the credit crisis of 07 and 08. And as we start to think about how one might go about quantifying or identifying systemically relevant institutions, I think it's actually helpful to back up and put a little historical perspective on this question. So as painful as it might be, I'm going to take a few minutes and drag us through the credit crisis of 07 and 08 one more time. And let me do it by sort of posing the discussion in terms of a question, which is really, why didn't the policymakers and others, see this credit crisis coming. Certainly some economists and financial commentators had talked for years of a bubble and home prices that could eventually collapse and lead to losses in the housing sector. Other economists and commentators, however, had argued that these rising home prices reflected economic fundamentals underlying the housing markets. And with 30 years of rising home prices in our history, that argument had a certain power to it. Now, with hindsight, of course, the bubble proponents may appear right, but they shouldn't blind us to the extent of disagreement among experts, both in the universities and in the government, on this point prior to the bust. But even those that saw a bubble coming and saw it in housing prices and saw that the likelihood of that busting did not see that this would lead to a freezing up of the credit markets and ultimately a widespread contraction in economic activity. For example, in the summer of 07, Chairman Bernanke was quoted as saying that the problems in the subprime market would be relatively contained and isolated and not spill over to the broader market. And just a moment of truthful confession here. At that same period, I was having lunch with a lawyer friend here in Washington who asked me, well, what about all these subprime problems? And I literally, not quoting Bernanke, but I basically said, oh, it'll be contained to the housing market and the subprime sector. We both were obviously wrong about that. But most observers, including the financial market experts and regulators, did not fully understand how the effects of the national housing bust would be magnified by several critical factors in the financial systems. These features are the widespread use of complex securities for funding mortgages, the narrow equity cushions or highly levered balance sheets of some financial institutions, and the heavy reliance on short-term financing, and the way they interacted to produce a freezing up of credit flows in the face of the housing bust, and ultimately to produce a contraction in real economic activity that, as we now know, many years later, fed back to worsen the problems. Let me quickly hit each of these in turn so we can talk about how they relate to systemic risk. In the past two decades, in the 90s and 2000s, new and more complex variations on asset-backed securities had been used extensively to facilitate mortgage finance and growth in home ownership. But the very complexity that was, for the most part, at least in my view, necessary for these securities to successfully address the problems inherent in lending to lower credit quality borrowers made it incredibly difficult to know where the credit risk actually resided or how to price that risk appropriately. In the aftermath of the housing bust, the result was a major increase in concerns about counterparty credit risk, even between highly rated financial institutions. In addition, there was a shortage of capital. Put it another way, there was an excess of leverage in the system, especially among the financial institutions as a whole. The capital cushions at major financial institutions had shrunk because of write-downs on these complex mortgage-related instruments and because of credit losses associated with the delinquencies and foreclosures on real estate loans. The excess leverage or narrow equity cushions increased the risk of insolvency and the credit losses and related asset write-downs. Finally, many of these highly levered financial institutions had come to rely extensively on short-term financing, often overnight loans, to fund their operations, making them even more vulnerable to runs or financial panics. As these individual firms struggled to increase their capital and delever, there were unintended and widely unanticipated systemic consequences. The firms tightened their lending standards, reduced the volume of loans, sold assets. But the unanticipated systemic impact of so many firms attempting to delever simultaneously was to depress asset prices, producing additional losses. These depressed prices resulted in turns and further losses and additional selling and write-downs and eroded equity cushions even further and, unfortunately, increasing leverage even further. The negative feedback cycle led to outright illiquidity in certain markets, making it extremely difficult to value these assets and eliminating the ability to use them as collateral for further lending. As the credit markets tightened, in some cases froze up, financial institutions became reluctant to lend, even to one another. Firms began hoarding liquidity, uncertain about what liquidity demands they might face and whether or not they could be met. The result of all these individual attempts to strengthen each affected firm's balance sheet was a systemic-wide reduction in the flow of credit in the economy, which in turn adversely impacted real economic activity and deepened and prolonged the recession as we've now lived through. So with that brief history in mind, let me turn to that question now. So if that's what we lived through, and at least in my view, those are the major causes of of the credit crisis. What are the lessons there for either quantifying systemic risk or trying to identify systemically relevant financial institutions? Let me just say that there are three NERA white papers dealing with this topic that are co-authored, that I am one of the co-authors of. My other co-authors are Chris Larson, who was a manager of market risk at the Federal Reserve Board, Sharon Brown-Huska, who was commissioner of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and John Vivenzi, who was chief operating officer at the FDIC. But with that group, we tried to address several issues related to the questions I've posed here. The first one really had to do with, well, is size alone a sufficient measure of systemic relevance? There was, at one point, there was proposals circulating on the Hill to basically just tax size and build up a fund that would be available for future bailouts so that taxes would not have to be increased. I think, and as we argue in one of our papers, size alone is certainly not an adequate measure. And the story, as I just related, of the credit crisis, it wasn't just size. There were many other factors and surprises taking place there that contributed to the crisis. In fact, I think probably if you had to pick one word that would relate to systemic relevance, it's not size. It would be interconnectedness. And that the concept of interconnectedness here is one that, you know, goes by other names, sometimes it's called contagion, spillovers. But we've tried to, in a second working paper, lay out what we mean by interconnectedness. And we've, in the context of a financial institution, we identify sort of direct interconnectedness through contractual obligations, indirect interconnectedness through, in some sense, behavioral interactions, asset prices that become correlated that typically aren't correlated, investors that refinance and cash out on their mortgages and basically reset the mortgages so that default now becomes a much more common occurrence. And also funding interconnectedness that can result from a freeze-up in the market or from the illiquidity. So as we take that perspective, in a third piece, we went on to try to say, is there a way in which you could use these concepts to try to rank the relative systemic risk of financial institutions? We identified 9 factors and laid out a CAMEL-like rating system that could be used, and this was done as a prototype and was tested, it could be used. And let me just hit the 9 factors. Some of them will sound familiar from the history I went through. Number 1 was interconnectedness. Number 2 was market concentration, either in products or geographic areas. Number 3 was implied product support, implicit support for instruments that there may not have been explicit, say, put options written on. 4th is the cyclicality of the financial results, to what extent when you do badly is everyone else doing poorly. 5th was transparency. 6th was liquidity. 7th was capitalization, or turn it around, the degree of leverage. And then finally, the combination of some of those factors, liquidity and interconnectedness, or the other relationships or contracts that are there that might mitigate or amplify these spillovers. We lay out in the third paper in our series, we lay out a framework whereby those could be scored, and then those scores could be aggregated to try to develop that. The framework was really meant to be a prototype to help provoke the debate and discussion and the rulemaking that's likely to be going on in this area. So with that, let me close, and if people want more detail, they're certainly encouraged to follow up with the papers. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Those remarks were from Dr. Robert McKay, and we turn next, please, if we could, to Dr. Faten Sabri.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Since the early stages of the credit crisis in 2007, securitization has been tagged as the villain. Many market participants, including regulators, analysts, and even some academics, had made the argument and continue to make the argument that securitization was a main contributor to the $2 trillion of losses and write-downs that the world has experienced to date. So it really comes as no surprise that the Dodd-Frank Act focused on various aspects of securitization and tried to regulate that. And in my talk today, I will not cover all aspects of the securitization new rules, but I would like to focus and discuss in detail a key aspect related to risk retention. And I want to focus on this particular aspect because I believe that, or I'd like to make the argument that it really goes beyond regulating the process of issuing asset-backed securities. The risk retention rules, the proposed rules now, they regulate the core economics of issuing these types of products. So it goes beyond what I think we think of as regulation. So in the next few minutes, what I'll do is I'll explain very quickly what I understand was the rationale for the risk retention rules, and I'll go very briefly as to the main highlights of these new proposed rules, and then I'll discuss what I think are the economic implications of the risk retention. As we all know, securitization is the process of pooling a lot of illiquid assets like mortgages, credit cards, auto loans into marketable securities. By design, securitization separates out the investors from originators. And yes, there is an economic rationale for this separation. The separation was meant to allow, to free up capital and allow originators to have additional money so that they can go out and make additional credit. This separation, according to a lot of the critics of securitization, is the problem. They say that because of the separation, the firms involved in securitization no longer have a skin in the game. And because they don't have a skin in the game, they have no incentive to properly underwrite the loans or to monitor the quality of the assets underlying these securities. And hence, the Dodd-Frank Act came in to make sure that the securitizers have a skin in the game. And basically, the Dodd-Frank Act requires 7 agencies to write up these rules. And we're talking about the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, the Treasury, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the FDIC, the SEC, and as well as the Department of Housing. And what these agencies collectively issued in the end of March of 2001 are basically a proposed set of rules requiring securitizers of asset-backed securities to retain an unhedged economic interest in a portion of the credit risk for the assets that they put together for sale. So very briefly, I'll outline very briefly what the main highlights of these new proposed rules, which have not passed yet, but this is what's on the table right now. 2 main questions. Who's required to retain that risk? According to the proposed rule, it's the sponsor, generally the sponsor of the securitization. And who's that? Well, what they mean by the sponsor, I believe, is the entity that organize and initiate the securitization transaction by selling or transferring these assets. Do they also require depositors to retain interest risk? No. Do they require originators to retain risk? Not necessarily, no. The main focus in the proposed rule is to ask the sponsor to retain that risk. What are the acceptable forms of risk retention? Well, according to the proposed rules, the sponsor is required to retain an economic interest equal to at least 5%, and there's no clear intuition for why 5%, but that's the rule, of the aggregate credit risk of these pools of assets. And the proposed rules basically lays out various ways you can retain that risk. One way is the sponsor could retain a vertical interest in the securitization. So you hold a 5% of each class in the issued ADS. You can also do horizontal first loss interest, and that option would expose the sponsor to the first loss position with respect to the entire asset pool. Another is what they call the L-shaped retention option, which would allow the securitizer or the sponsor to use a combination of a vertical and a horizontal. There are other alternatives too that were placed there. One is that the sponsor would take an interest in a representative sample But again, as long as it is 5%, and as long as the sponsor can show that it's a representative sample, there are many other ways that are other forms. And the reason why they are, I believe, they are putting forth many different alternatives is because there are many different forms of securitizations, and it's not really realistic to expect that one form would or one size would fit all. There are exemptions, of course. Who is exempted from this requirement? Well, Fannie and Freddie, of course. As long as they are under the conservatorship of the FHFA, they are not required to retain interest. As well as the another exemption, important exemption, is what the proposed rule called the qualified residential mortgages. So the rules define the qualified residential mortgages by setting certain minimum underwriting standards. They're very strict standards. For example, you can be a qualified residential mortgage if you put 20% down, that the loan-to-value ratio cannot be more than 75%. The borrower could not have been more than 60-day late, for example, on any debt obligation in the last 24 months or so. So very, very strict rules. And this would be qualified as the other exemption. It's very important to remember that there is the prohibition on hedging. According to the rule, which is very important, and that goes to how costly the rules will be once the sponsors start to apply them. The sponsor may not sell or transfer any interest or assets that he's required to retain under these rules. So that's very important to the sponsors of who are going to be affected by these rules. I have very quick comments on the possible implications of these rules. And before I say so, I would like to recognize that it was a very difficult task for these agencies to try and put together a rule that will align incentives of the different parties of securitization. Having said that, I have a couple of comments. One, there are various mechanisms of risk retention that already exist that have actually functioned quite well even during the credit crisis, that the rules are completely ignoring them. For example, excess spread, particularly for credit card securitizations, cash flow diversion mechanisms, letters of credit from banks, and other mechanisms. They do exist, but the rules are meant to apply on top of these other credit enhancement methods. Another interesting observation here is that these proposed rules do not pay much attention to controlling originators directly, right? When you think about risks from securitization, you think of two types of risks: economic risks. This has to do with, you know, risk of housing prices, unemployment rates, and so on. But then you will think of origination risk. And what the rules are trying to do is they're trying to limit the amount of economic risk that the sponsor can shed. But they completely ignore origination risk directly, or they don't address it directly. And that's something, an observation that I'm not quite sure why that is, if the goal is to align incentives. The rules don't cover synthetics, and they don't seem to allow retention to be reduced over time. Finally, I have and I rethink this is where economic analysis could be very valuable to the process, is that the important question that was left unanswered here, even by the studies that were done by the Treasury and by the Financial Stability Council, is what is the impact of these new rules on the ability of securitization to provide credit to consumers and businesses and the cost of that credit? So the academic literature, economists from the Bank of International Settlements as well as the IMF have looked into the issue of optimal retention scheme, one of their main conclusions is that it really depends on a variety of factors, including quality of loans and the economic conditions expected during the lifetime of the transaction. So to conclude, it would be great to have a retention scheme that promote a greater attention to risk as long as it does not introduce restrictions so burdensome that it would eliminate securitization altogether. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've just been hearing from Dr. Faten Sabri, and we turn now to Dr. James Overdahl.
Thank you for the invitation today to offer my perspective on the role of economic analysis, or more specifically cost-benefit analysis or regulatory impact analysis, in the Dodd-Frank rulemaking process. This process is currently underway at several federal regulatory agencies, including the SEC, who are now engaged in nearly 100 Dodd-Frank rulemakings. The importance and timeliness of this topic was highlighted this past Friday when the D.C. Circuit vacated the SEC's proxy access rule, citing the Commission's failure to adequately consider the rule's economic effects. The Court's decision was significant because the proxy access rule was the first rule finalized as part of the implementation of the Dodd-Frank Act. The case is one of several court challenges to SEC rules in the past 6 years, where the outcomes have turned on the adequacy of the economic support considered by the Commission when adopting new rules. My goal today is to describe the role of economic analysis in the federal rulemaking process and to also describe how interested parties, in response to recent court challenges, are devoting more attention to the quality of their economic arguments when engaging in the public comment process. My comments apply generally to the federal rulemaking process and are not specific to the Dodd-Frank rulemakings. However, the sheer number of Dodd-Frank rulemakings and the magnitude of their potential economic consequences have increased the public's attention paid to the role of economic analysis in these rulemakings. At the SEC, there are no formal requirements for the Commission to conduct cost-benefit analysis in their rulemaking, aside from the cost-benefit requirements of the Paperwork Reduction Act, and these apply only to the rule's paperwork burden. And although there are no formal requirements to conduct economic analysis at the SEC, indirect requirements come from two main sources. First, the Administrative Procedure Act, or APA, which requires that federal regulatory agencies like the SEC adequately justify their exercise of rulemaking authority. Although the APA does not specifically require economic analysis, it does require that federal rulemaking have a reasoned basis and not be, quote, arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with the law, end quote. Second, individual statutes, such as the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, may also require regulators to consider specific economic effects, such as whether a regulatory action will promote efficiency, competition, and capital formation. Recent court decisions regarding challenges to SEC rules have turned on the adequacy of the economic analysis considered by the Commission when adopting new rules. These court decisions have shown that failure to adequately consider the economic effects of a proposed rule can demonstrate a lack of a reasoned basis for adopting the rule and render its adoption arbitrary and capricious. In the recent proxy access case, the D.C. Circuit found that the SEC, quote, inconsistently and opportunistically framed the costs and benefits of the rule, failed adequately to quantify the certain costs or explain why those costs could not be quantified, neglected to support its predictive judgments, contradicted itself, and failed to respond to substantial problems raised by commenters. The message from the courts in this case and similar cases over the past 6 years has been that regulators' economic arguments need to be adequately supported, and that vigorous assertion is not a substitute for rigorous economic analysis. It is worth noting that Even the specific instruction from Congress for the SEC to promulgate proxy access rules before a set deadline did not relieve the Commission of its duty to adopt rules fully in accordance with the APA and the Commission's governing statute without cutting any corners. As a result of recent court challenges, parties affected by proposed rules now regard the notice and comment rulemaking process as if it were part of a legal proceeding. Affected parties are placing on the public record factual information about likely compliance costs and offering studies and analysis to help inform regulators. Because of the potential for litigation, parties are directing their comments not only to the members of the regulatory commission involved in adopting rules, but also to the judges who may be reviewing the public record if rules are challenged in court. Because commenters have become more sophisticated, the goalposts for the SEC have moved. The court is now scrutinizing the quality of the economic analysis itself and is no longer confined, as they were in the past, to scrutinizing whether any economic analysis was used to support the commission's assertions about economic effects. In last week's decision, the D.C. Circuit found that the SEC failed to respond to substantial problems raised by commenters, citing a study co-authored by NERA economist Elaine Buckberg and Yale economist Jonathan Macy as one example. This study had been placed on the record by the Business Roundtable, one of the parties that ended up challenging the SEC proxy access rule. In the end, the use of economic analysis is more than simply satisfying procedural and court requirements. It can help improve regulatory decision-making. I have found from my experience at the SEC that commissioners welcome rigorous, data-driven economic analysis. It helps them sort out common sense from common nonsense. Such analysis enhances the ability of commissioners to ask better questions, better understand trade-offs, and consequences associated with the proposed rule, and make more informed decisions. In my view, economic analysis captures more than what is typically called cost-benefit analysis or regulatory impact analysis. Under my interpretation, economic analysis goes beyond what is readily quantifiable, such as out-of-pocket compliance costs, and includes consideration of the trade-offs, potential effects, and unintended consequences of regulatory actions, including identifying potential changes in behavior by market participants. It can also be helpful at the very earliest stages of the rulemaking process by helping the Commission frame the problem that is being addressed by a proposed regulatory action. Perhaps the most important contribution of economic analysis to the rulemaking process is that it helps enhance the overall transparency and accountability of the process. There is no obligation, of course, for commissioners to abide by the results of economic analysis, only that this analysis be responsibly considered. But discounting the economic analysis requires explanation, and this is where the accountability is injected into the process. Although it has been the SEC that has faced the most scrutiny from the courts with respect to the use of economic analysis, scholars have observed a broader issue across other so-called independent regulatory commissions. These are commissions like the SEC that are not part of the executive branch and not subject to oversight by the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, or OIRA, and nor are they subject to executive orders on federal rulemaking. One recent study found that in many instances, the independent regulatory commissions appear to be issuing major regulations without reporting any quantitative information on benefits or costs apart from the paperwork burden. Instead, there is only a qualitative discussion of the benefits and costs. The independent regulatory commissions present this discussion without any formal review of alternatives. Their analysis generally do not consider behavioral change. They also do not estimate possible and unintended effects, and perhaps most importantly, with the exceptions of the paperwork burden, their analyses of economic effects are not prepared to comply with any identifiable standards for such analysis. Because of court challenges based on the economic analysis and the general concerns, such as those I just cited about independent regulatory commissions, Congress has recently held a series of hearings on the topic. One thing that has emerged from these hearings is that there is general support for process reforms aimed at bolstering the economic analysis conducted by independent regulatory commissions. One proposal is to establish third-party review of the economic analysis in the same way that the executive branch agencies have their analyses reviewed by OIRA. Although separation of powers concerns have been raised, the recent congressional hearings have outlined a path that would preserve the independence of regulatory commissions but include third-party review. In one proposal, OIRA would review the economic analysis, but the commission would retain veto authority over any objections they raise. There also have been proposals for post-enactment review and greater use of pilot programs to improve the analysis associated with federal rulemakings. These, again, are general to all federal rulemakings, but have been given heightened importance recently because of the scale and magnitude of the Dodd-Frank rulemakings, and I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Overdahl. And thank you also to our two other speakers, Dr. McKay and Sabri. If we could open things up for a conversation among the group, let me just reflect back that I notice that one theme that ran through each of the presentations was some effort to identify risk, and yet there are, in a sense, different types of risk that seem to be discussed. There's a systemic risk, for example, a special form of risk of some type, and yet absent from then the conversation was a risk as Dr. Sabri pointed out, is explicitly exempted from the proposed rules, the risk that is ordinary risk built into mortgages that are backed by the government-sponsored entities, Fannie and Freddie. And this, of course, was a risk that was purposefully taken off the table for the lead-up to the problem because of a desire to focus on something other than what Dr. Overdahl's been talking about, cost-benefit analysis. It was a desire to focus on a different agenda, an important agenda we probably all support, a social agenda, but orthogonal to risk, totally unrelated to risk. Are there ways to pay attention to that basic underlying credit risk without fundamentally frustrating that social or policy agenda?
Let me take a first shot at that. And certainly there are ways. And in my list of factors that would go into determining the systemic relevance of a financial institution, the extent of its credit exposure, that is just the sheer size of it, the concentration of that credit exposure, the extent to which its credit exposures are correlated across the different assets it holds. Those are all an important part of what would be looked at and what should be looked at. The fact that there may have been government, I heard various parts to your question and your comments there. So let me hit it in two pieces. So, yeah, of course, credit risk is a critical part of what we're talking about here. And it's a critical factor that the firms themselves have processes and procedures and quantification methods in place for attempting to deal with that. It's also something that has to be a part of this systemic risk considerations. The role that the GSEs, which is sort of taken off the table, which we don't really put back on the table, and will be dealt with, that's a very important part of this. And that's a piece that can't be, shouldn't be ignored. And whatever role the government had in encouraging the expansion of credit risk, in particular in the housing market, and I think is an important part of the credit crisis story, as I at least hinted at in my overview of the crisis. Let me turn it over to Fatten, if she'd like to take a shot at it.
Right. I will echo what Robert said, that yes, there are ways you can, of course, address that risk. But it does seem to me that what the Dodd-Frank did is, once the rules are applied, it would not limit the private label securitization and implicitly continue to subsidize the government-sponsored enterprises, whether they are in conservatorship or even if they find a way to get out of it. And that in itself speaks to their you know, what the regulators, I guess, want is that you will, we want only, prime borrowers to have access to credit, and we're going to shut the door on anybody who is less than, you know, who has less than stellar credit. And is this the optimal, policy to do? It's not clear to me why it is. But that's what we, the three of us independently have read into, what the act is meant to do.
Just to pick up, if you like, to pick up on that point, right? Certainly part of the credit crisis was an overextension of credit,
right,
encouragement by the government, by the financial sector, where home ownership became a goal in itself, and the extension of mortgage credit to homeowners very broadly obviously means pushing down on the credit, the credit ranking when you do that. That was an important part of that. If we now are going to overreact
in the other direction,
that's not the right point to be, right? So that somewhere it should be in the middle. And as you were walking through your comments, I was struck by, I mean, one thing that surprised me about the credit crisis, among many, I guess, was the actual extent to which the banks retained credit exposure to these. I mean, I was surprised to see the large numbers come out when they came out in terms of mortgage-related exposure that I thought the business models in some sense said, you know, you originate to distribute, right? And you pass it on.
So. And actually, just to very quickly, the IMF had done a study recently. They looked at over 10,000 securitizations, and they found that the banks, the sponsors of securitization, have increasingly been retaining risk over time, especially for the more complex structures. And part of that could be there because they were trying to hedge their other positions. But the thing is, just to echo, there is actual quantitative evidence to show that the banks were retaining a lot of that risk, even the lower tranches of these securitizations on their books.
Many of the equity tranches, and the quantitative evidence is the losses that showed up on their,
yes,
on their balance sheets.
Yeah.
Is it possible that part of the reason they did that was to manage political risk, so that they could say that they were actively supporting the social policy agenda by credibly, in fact saying, look, we are loaning to people who don't meet, modest, goals for being as an individual family a credit risk. We're lending to them nonetheless because the oversight committees have told Fannie and Freddie that they should tell us that we're good guys if we do that and bad guys if we don't. So we want to show our political bona fides by being good guys and by playing in that space.
Jim, you want to take a shot at that highly charged, loaded question?
Well, I'm not sure that I am prepared to answer that question right at the moment, but clearly Freddie and Fannie are the elephants in the room, and it is one of the glaring holes in the entire response to the crisis, and I think probably the most reasonable explanation was that nobody could figure out what to do, at least in the timetable that was people were working under. So I think we're seeing that process play out now. You're seeing more discussion. You've seen a Treasury proposal out in the last few months. So I think attention is being turned to that now, but it may have been that it just was too complicated and controversial to handle during the time frame that was before Congress in responding to the crisis.
Start with you, Jim, on this round of question, but open it up to everybody. You mentioned the importance of existing mechanisms within the government apparatus to engage in a community conversation about cost-benefit analysis. And you highlighted the difference between agencies that go through OIRA review and agencies that don't. Is it your sense that, generally speaking, we see better, at least today, cost-benefit analysis being conducted by those that go through that process?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I am aware of some scholars who have looked at that issue. And I know that there are scholars at Resources for the Future who have looked at that. And one of the things that I'm not sure if it's a formal finding, but I know that it's been shared anecdotally, is that when there's review by someone, some third-party review, it doesn't really matter who, that the quality of the work improves. And as long as people know that there's going to be somebody scrutinizing their work, that generally the quality rises as a result. And perhaps what we're seeing now is that certainly the D.C. Circuit has caught the attention of financial market regulators as a result of the decisions related to the SEC over the last few years. The regulators are certainly responding because they know that the D.C. Circuit may be reviewing their work. But there could be a process in place that would make that more standardized so that it would not be something that would have to go through the court proceedings to get that review.
Just some personal experience here. In the 80s, I spent several years associated with the Federal Trade Commission when Jim Miller was chairman there. And that's an agency that has a very strong economics culture to it, always has, by the nature of it, will. And there, in my experience, the cost-benefit analysis that was done, the regulatory impact analysis that was done after the fact to see, did the funeral rule actually, how did it actually affect funeral pricing and funeral services? It was quite rigorous. There are other agencies, and I would lump the SEC into that, that don't have that same strong economic culture that, say, the FTC had. Jim also was at the CFTC, and she was chief economist there, and I think maybe, you know, my experience at that agency was there's a much stronger economic culture there than at, say, the SEC. So my guess is it varies by agency.
I think you're right. It does, but I also think it's more than good intentions. That I think, based on my experience from 21 years of the federal government, I've seen many fits and starts. I've seen many different chairmen at different agencies come in with ambitions about improving the quality of the analysis, and it may last during that chairman's tenure, but then it'll be forgotten about. And so I think there needs to be some structure to this. I think it has to be something more than just good intentions.
No, I was going to say, you know, given the scope and the size of the Dodd-Frank and the its impact on the variety, you know, on various financial institutions, I think and I hope that regulators will take time to actually think about economic impact studies properly, because this is very, very serious. The economic implications of curtailing credit even more than what it is today because of these new rules is very real.
Well, maybe if nothing else than the records getting built in response to the notice and comment period might provide perhaps informal focal point coordination vehicle for the type of review mechanism, even if there's no formal organization tasked with that activity.
It can be a substitute. It's not the best, but it does have a couple of virtues. One is that when outside commenters place on the record economic analysis, it forces the commission to engage more fully their own economic staff to respond, and as I think that brings in the economic analysis that way. But I don't think you want commissions relying solely on outside commenters. And I think we've seen also that sometimes commenters are constrained on what they can offer on the public record because it may actually be information that they don't want to share with the world. And there needs to be some confidential mechanism for information to flow. I know when I was at the SEC and the CFTC, we would oftentimes be frustrated by public comments because they would not share with us their expectations on compliance costs and other factors.
And we had no method of surveying firms confidentially because of other constraints under the Paperwork Reduction Act, for example, that prohibited us from asking the same question to more than nine people.
Right.
So there are constraints on gathering information that could result in better decision making, as well as business concerns that would prevent firms from maybe offering on the record information that regulators would like to have.
Yeah, and even the so-called Sunshine Act sometimes ends up being the opposite in its effect in that way. Maybe just a flag, I guess, for us all to revisit in the future to see whether this plays out. It might be interesting to ask later whether the searching cost-benefit analysis that one hopes will occur via some organization or mechanism, whether that will end up being kind of effective or in the kind of postmodern sense, just the fig leaf for something that's actually not good, but to which somebody can then respond and say, oh, and I ran my cost-benefit analysis. The cost-benefit analysis may not be good, but having run it, I've now satisfied my APA requirement that I run it. So we see in different parts of the space that game being played.
Yeah, and I think that's a concern. You don't want this to become just a go through the motions exercise. I think it is important that when you say effective, what do we mean by effective? I guess in one sense we want it to produce better rules, but I think also the goals are broader than that, and that is to add transparency to the process and accountability. And what I mean by accountability is that if commissioners or regulators want to disregard the economic analysis, they have to put their reasons on the record, and they have to be accountable for that decision.
So then isn't there a bit of tension here between the so-called economist desire to get it right, if you will, and the political scientist desire to think about a different market that gets made? So if I'm a political actor and I find out that a particular activity will cost or save X amount of dollars or jobs, hasn't that fact just made a market for me politically? Because if I can then hold that up to some interest group who can then lobby me and explain to me that their view on that issue will get to the same outcome plus one or minus one, depending on whether it's a good or a bad, then I can become a focal point for that, for political power or contributions from both of those groups. I've now made a market and I've become the auctioneer in that market. And doesn't modern political science teach us that any self-interested government actor who has to be democratic, so some of these agencies are further down in the org chart, but those that are more democratic, more open to being elected or democratic power, the more responsive they are to that, doesn't this open up to them the rational self-interest to worry, in fact, about social or political gain rather than economic efficiency?
Well, I'm not sure economic analysis can solve that problem. That, as I see it, the role of economic analysis in these type of rulemaking decisions is to inform the process and to make sure that the commissioners have the type of information they need to make a reasoned decision. But we have to remember that the people who are in these positions are political appointees. They have a lot of considerations to factor into a decision, and they are there to exercise their judgment, but you hope that when they exercise that judgment that it's a fully informed judgment. And of course, these factors that you mentioned can play out, but I'm sure they play out in the absence of that information as well.
And so, that information may now actually be on the record as opposed to
That's where I think it adds the accountability to the process.
So then, as we come near the hour, if we could maybe take a moment with each of you to just ask an open-ended question. There probably are people out there who are their staff in a legislative body or their staff in an administrative body, and they're thinking to themselves, what could I do differently? What advice, targeted advice, would you give somebody in one of those settings or a different setting? What one or two pearls of wisdom or requests for mindfulness, what would you ask them in the future to be just a little bit more attentive to?
Well, let me answer that in relation to the topic I was asked to address. And in designing regulations that are meant to deal with systemic risk, meant to deal with the problems that we, financial problems we went through in 2007 and 8, it seems to me that it's critical to first get the understanding of what happened right, to have a solid understanding of the causes, before one starts designing the fixes. And that in many cases, without that analysis of the causes, the proposed fixes, as I think some of Fatten's examples would illustrate, that can actually make things worse instead of fixing it. So deep study of the causes should precede the implementation of the fixes. Brief words of wisdom.
Fatten?
Right. I would completely agree with what Robert said, in particular in the context of the risk retention rules. It is, I would have loved to see, if I was asked to think about this risk retention scheme and what is the optimal way to do it, is to actually think seriously about, real data. We use serious data on defaults, on losses, and address that as economists do, because it really is an economic question, not a legal issue, not a political issue either. So,
if I was addressing a legislative assistant, I would remind them that the reason the federal rulemaking process exists at all is because Congress has delegated certain tasks to regulators to figure out. And oftentimes, they've delegated the most difficult tasks. The things that were hardest to figure out would be left to the regulators to figure out. And so that if you don't like that process, then there's always the option of Congress filling in those blanks in the statute. So the process exists because of the authority that Congress has given the regulators to fill in the blanks that Congress has not filled in.
Well, Jim, Fatten, Bob, thank you for sharing your insights into this complex web of economic issues in the implementation of financial regulation. Your views have been stimulating, and the issues raised significant to the debate on the impact of Dodd-Frank going forward. Today's broadcast will be available in audio MP3 format soon, and an edited transcript will be added later. The program will be accessible in both programs and the best of NERA sections at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's next broadcast will be Bingham Presents 2011 on September 13th, looking at enforcement after Dodd-Frank. The online broadcast will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. My colleague, Professor Jeffrey Manns, will moderate the program with presenters Robert Kuzami, SEC Director of Enforcement, David Meister, Director of Enforcement at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and Susan Merrill of Bigham McCutcheon LLP, and former Head of Enforcement at FINRA. Please plan to join on www.sechistorical.org on Tuesday, September 13th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Bigham Presents 2011. Thank you for being with us today.